So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, Harry and Meghan break up for good with the British tabloids, Disney's coronavirus response threatens to damage the reputation of the mouse, and Channel 4 try to woo advertisers with free use of their creative team. Plus, has the sun set for good on this year's Love Island? And in the media quiz, we play HBO or no, with the fresh shows landing on the latest big streaming launch. It's all to come in today's Media Podcast. First up, returning to the fray, the international editor of Deadline magazine, Jake Cantor, is here. Hi, Jake.
Hi, I'm good. You didn't ask me how I was.
I wasn't, but you're right to answer as if I had, because it would have been more polite. You've been tweeting, I noticed, about the grim news from Kevin Ligo this week. You reckon we could, reading between the lines, be about to see Love Island being axed?
Well, I mean, he's just done Edinburgh TV festival session over YouTube. It's part of a series of discussions that the TV controllers in the UK are having about coronavirus and what it's done to the industry. And I would say Kevin has delivered the most starkly honest appraisal, plain speaking overview of what is happening at the moment. And I mean, it's not great, as you would imagine. And I think, like you say, one of the big casualties probably is going to be Love Island. He talked about the logistics of making it being very difficult, you know, the feasibility of actually flying 200 people over to Mallorca without them all being quarantined or just refused entry. And then he sort of talked about the tone of the show at this time. You know, he used the phrase, you know, is it a good thing to see strangers slathering over each other? At a time when we can't even go near each other in a park.
Could be queasy viewing, but could be escapism as well, I guess.
That's true. And it's a huge revenue generator for ITV, so it'll be a very tough decision. He hasn't ruled it out completely, so there's still wiggle room that it might happen, but I would be surprised. I think he was kind of teeing up the nation for a Love Island-free summer.
Yeah, Love Island Wiggle Room sounds like one of the spin-off shows on ITV2. Also returning to us, Professor Emeritus at City University, Professor Liz Howell. Hello, Liz.
Hi.
You've been buried in research all week. What are you working on?
Oh, absolutely. We do this survey research about how many women experts are interviewed on news programmes, 6 flagship news programmes. And it's really interesting, but we've done a sort of few deep dives into the figures and it's fascinating, but I just feel as if I've been so immersed in it, I don't really know what else is going on. So forgive me if I'm not really on top of the other stories. I'll just have to really try.
Have you still got your army of counters looking at the quotient of female representation, or is it literally you now sitting there with the VCR spooling back through everything?
I wish. No, it's a really small but perfectly formed army. It's sort of SAS force, really. We have student monitors, postgraduate student monitors, who look at the programmes and write down every single person that's on the programme and categorise them as experts or non-experts. And then we put it all together and work out the averages. And we are actually announcing this on the Women's Hour programme on Monday, May the 4th. What you do find is that, male experts do go up at a certain point, and we've looked at why that is, and I feel that the blame firmly lies with the very high proportion of men in government and government advisors. But the actual figures will have to wait for Monday. But it is a story. It really is a story.
But coronavirus has had an impact, just to give us the headline.
Yes. It's also interesting is that the story, just the narrative changes as the months go on. And when we get deeper into the story, and the story moves to hospitals and care homes, and far more women are interviewed.
Okay, well, and finally, we have a third guest. I insist on it these days, just in case we lose one along the way remotely. But what a fine guest we have. CNN's media and entertainment reporter, Frank Pallotta, making his media podcast debut. Hello, Frank.
Hi, how are you on?
Not bad, thank you. You're in your parents' house?
I'm in currently my mom's attic, which is very, very interesting. Last night, I had to do my first on-air kind of like video interview, and I had to do it for my mom's attic, and I also had to use my mom's makeup, so it was very much a Norman Bates moment for me, and I was, you know, it was pretty good, you know? I think it went pretty well, and you know, mother enjoyed it, so everything went well for me.
How are you cutting through the press release bullshit when you aren't able to go and meet people face-to-face and work out what's really going on?
Luckily, I have a great bullshit detector, and I've had that for like 6 years now. So the way you kind of just cut through it is, what I've been telling people more and more lately is that anyone who kind of tells you this is exactly how things are going to go or exactly how things are not going to go, you got to be able to be very upfront and say that a lot of what we're going through right now is somewhat speculative. We're trying to figure out what the next step is for the movie theaters and the next step for big companies like Disney. And we have to really think about, you know, what is coming next, but no one is 100% sure. That's why it's important to have reporters and have media people really be able to, you know, step up, who have been doing this for a long time, like myself, who can be very upfront to audiences and readers and say, you know, this is our best guess. This is our best estimates. This is what we're hearing from sources. Here's what we're thinking, because this coronavirus pandemic is a game changer in every single way across media, the economy, the whole entire culture of the world. And it's important to kind of figure that out. So you have to cut through the press release by just being a good reporter is the short form of it.
Well, you talk about what might be happening next for Disney. Let's start this week by talking about what's happening now, because the company has stopped paying more than 100,000 employees this week. Frank, most of those staff are in the States. Obviously, it does impact their movie businesses across Europe and staff at Disneyland Paris and stuff, but generally they're in the USA. Right. What has the reaction been there to this announcement? They are an enormous corporation and they're taking government assistance to socialize laying off their staff effectively through furlough.
Well, if you think about it this way, Disney is made up of four major units. It's media networks, which is ABC, ESPN. It's theme parks / consumer / experience unit, which is mostly the parks and merchandising. It's studio entertainment, which is focused on obviously the films, the blockbusters like Marvel and Star Wars. And it's new DTC, which is direct to consumer, which is Disney Plus. 52% of that, 52% of the revenues of its fiscal year last year was studio entertainment and parks, which have just been immensely hobbled by the coronavirus pandemic. So that means more than half of the company is just kind of halted right now. And then if you look at the media networks, ESPN's showing, you know, cherry spitting and NFL draft virtually. It's not showing NBA playoffs or the Masters or Major League Baseball opening day. So Disney has been really kind of hobbled by this pandemic as much as, you know, the rest of the economy and the rest of the world has too. But it's incredibly vulnerable, more so than other media networks like, you know, NBC Universal, which is owned by Comcast, and media and Warner Media, which is my parent company, which is owned by AT&T. That's because Disney has made itself, has created an empire, I should say, from bringing people together for the last 95 years, packing theme parks, packing movie theaters. Social distancing makes that nearly impossible. So that they've had to furlough, the numbers have been everywhere between 40,000 employees to the report you're talking about, I believe was in Financial Times, which is closer to about 100,000. The number's not really distinct, but it's somewhere in that range, to anyone whose, quote, job is not necessary at this time. And, you know, the market has
been
kind of—
But that is socializing the law. Losses and keeping the profits, isn't it? That's the accusation. You know, this isn't a company that is short of cash. They're able to spread around billions to buy Fox and Lucasfilm. Bob Iger's earning 900 times what the median Disney employee is. That's where the anger's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, let's be quite honest. Last year, Disney had 7 $1 billion movies. You know, many people have been outspoken, as you said, about this. So yes, that's why people are kind of outraged about it as well. But also people are trying to figure out if Disney's going to come back because, you know, Disney is a lifestyle brand for many people in the same way that Nike or Apple is. You know, people are also very curious about it. And at the same time, you know, people are sitting home right now watching Disney Plus and just thinking about, you know, potentially getting out of the house with their kids to go back to a theme park or go see a Disney movie. So it's not just cut and dry in terms of the financial. There's also this huge cultural connection for many millions of people when it comes to Disney.
And that's a really interesting point. I mean, Liz, do you think that the Disney suite of brands and people's attachment to those now is so strong that, in a sense, their PR doesn't matter? Like Apple, there are, you know, there have been stories about conditions in the Foxconn factories making Apple phones, but it hasn't damaged people's relationship with, in the West, with that brand. Do you think people just value Disney so highly that the PR can be put to one side?
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. I mean, 28 million paying customers have been put on with the new streaming channel. That's an awful lot of people straight off the bat. And there is this tremendous affection for Disney. I was on a board which had Disney shareholders way back in 1993, and they are, in my opinion and my experience, a very hard-nosed company when it comes to business, which is quite unlike the sort of slightly schmaltzy image you have of Disney. But they do manage to get away with that because there is this enormous public affection for them. Also, I think it's something to do with the structure of the company. As Frank said, it's very firmly divided into groups. And I can imagine their thinking is that they're not going to have the media side bailing out the hospitality side, which is very different. So that's one way they make their business work. I mean, the two are related, but they're different.
And Jake, do you understand the structure of Disney? Because you report on this stuff too. And I mean, Bob Iger is now, I believe, the executive chairman. That's his job title. Is he really running it rather than Bob Chapek, who's supposed to be his successor? I mean, what's he still doing there?
Well, I think the idea is that they have some sort of handover period and Bob will eventually retire into the wings and Bob Iger, that is.
And Bob too, yeah.
And Bob Chapek will assume, you know, total control. I think that's kind of the thinking behind that at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I would agree with everything that's been said. I think Disney has been storming it with Disney Plus, which has created a bit of a halo effect around the brand. But the reality is that it's been kind of disproportionately exposed to coronavirus because of the hulking physical business that it is. You know, it's got these huge theme parks and hotels, and lots of people to pay. I think Abigail Disney, the granddaughter of co-founder Roy Disney, made some good points. She's been quite scathing about all of this. She said that Disney needs to pay the people who make the magic happen and the company must do better. And I think when you've got the heir to the Disney fortune saying that, then something's wrong.
Frank, you're anticipating Disney's earnings results on Tuesday. What are you expecting to hear?
I think investors are going to be very eager to see just how deeply the company has been impacted by the coronavirus. And I think we're going to see theme parks take a big hit. I think we're going to see studios take a big hit. I don't think there's anything super surprising there. You got to remember that Disney has been dealing with this as a global company since the coronavirus appeared in China. They've been dealing with this a lot longer than before their domestic parks went down. I think also you're going to see them really kind of push forward on how well Disney Plus has been doing. I mean, it's crossed 50 million subscribers. It's done that in just about 5 months. And they originally, their initial projections were about 60 to 90 by the end of 2024. They're almost there. So I think they're going to really push towards the future here. But I also think they're going to do a lot of, you know, saying, you know, this is a 500-year storm. This is something that hit them after their biggest year ever. And I think, you know, it should be noted that it's not like people are suddenly bored of Disney. This is something that hit the company out of nowhere. It's not like people were not going to the parks or not going to see Disney movies. They had to shut down because of this crisis.
Liz, media professors like you up and down the country that are having young people approach them virtually, I guess, now, and ask them whom they should apply to for a job, Where should they be sending their CV? Who should they be networking with? I mean, it's just an impossible scenario now, isn't it?
It's incredibly difficult. I mean, where do they go? My advice would be send it to absolutely everybody all the time. You just don't know who might be looking for somebody as a bit of an emergency, who may be hiring because one of their staff isn't able to perform in some way. But on the other hand, I think that, for example, one of my students is now working at Lidl, and I think that's probably a very sensible move in the short term, because it's not going to bounce back very quickly and it's going to take time. It will bounce back because media is so, so important, and that's one thing that's really been demonstrated. I mean, quite frankly, in news journalism, which is my speciality, the news has become absolutely vital. I don't know what viewing figures are, but from everybody I know in the news business is saying that ratings are through the roof for news programmes. They are almost like, well, they are key workers. If you're a news journalist, your child's entitled to a place at school because you're a key worker. There's part of me that thinks we sort of ought to clap for broadcast journalists on a Thursday night as well, but that will never happen, let's be honest. But it is so important, and in a way what's happening is that the importance of this profession is being established more than ever. So I do think the jobs will be there in the future, but it's just this, like everything else, it's on hold, isn't it? It's so difficult.
Yeah, cuts and furloughs announced in the last few weeks as well from Bauer and Condé Nast. The team I work with at Dennis Publishing as well, for whom I make a podcast, I know that they've got some furloughs coming down the track as well. Let's change channels now onto Channel 4, who have offered out the use of their in-house creative team to make adverts for free. Jake, tell us, what are Channel 4 offering exactly?
Well, they're basically offering the services of 4 Creative, which is a award-winning team behind some very memorable advertising campaigns, such as Channel 4's fantastic Meet the Superhumans Paralympics promotion. They're offering those services up to the value of about £20,000. I think it's a smart idea to lure in some advertisers, and I presume keep some of the 4 Creative team in gainful employment, because they're probably not very busy right now.
But which brands really are going to want to use pre-existing footage or an in-house creative team for a channel, you know, when they're used to a world of agencies and creating their own copy?
I think I find this rather odd. I mean, when you see a lot of the adverts that are on at the moment, that they're already going for home footage and much cheaper sort of types of adverts, are very effective in many ways. What is the attraction of the Channel 4 creative team to these people? It's almost as if that's not the sort of ad that we're going for at the moment. Also, if you look at something like ITV, in the 6:30 news in the break, there's this cooperation between BT and ITV telling you how to do tech, which is quite funny sometimes. It really works sometimes. Other times it's a bit, you know, cringe-worthy, but it does work. But it's so different from ads as we know them. So, I mean, I'm almost thinking, Do companies really want to have glossy ads at this time? It's just not the style.
I would counter that and say that, you know, from a creative, from an editorial point of view, we're hearing all of the major broadcasters now saying that audiences are tiring very quickly of the sort of the coronavirus look, the Zoom conference calls that we're seeing on television. And I think that will be reflected in advertising ultimately. You know, TV commissioners are looking for big escapist content, and I think ultimately to differentiate themselves, companies like supermarkets will have to turn to some bigger ideas.
Frank, what is the advertising break looking like over in the States at the moment? How has the lockdown affected the commercials people are seeing?
Well, there's a lot of like commercials that everything seemingly has a message about getting through this together. Pretty much everything from toilet paper companies to pharmacies. Like, it's just, it has this feeling of you went from selling you something to talking to you more about like what our companies are doing to get through this crisis, at least from the commercials I've seen. But it's funny because like, the other thing too is I'm watching a ton of streaming, and so are a lot of other people, which you just don't see those ads at all. So there has been, you know, a change and a shift, but that's what I've seen mostly, is this kind of message first, selling something later.
I mean, the big advertiser here in the UK, Jake, that's new is the government. We've seen that the government's going to spend £35 million on newspaper advertising alone over the next 3 months as part of the COVID-19 information campaign. Do you think it's the right decision for them to target print? It seems to be at the expense perhaps of other advertising mediums.
I'm not sure it is. I think it's great that they're targeting print, because that's revenue for newspapers, and that is a good thing.
But who's buying a newspaper? I mean, who's going out and getting a physical newspaper? We're being told only to go out and buy the essentials.
That's true, and newspaper circulation has suffered significantly as a result of what we're going through right now. But I don't think it's just solely print. I mean, both Channel 4 and ITV both ITV and Channel 4 have spoken about the fact that the government is spending more money with them, and that is a good thing, particularly at a time when Channel 4 particularly has been hit very, very hard by coronavirus. You know, its advertising revenue has halved in the last couple of months, and it's got to find savings of £150 million. It's furloughed 100 staff. Government spending money with these broadcasters is important right now.
What do you make, Liz, of Channel 4's efforts, actually? Because they've been the most, out of the public service broadcast, seems to me, they've been the most agile. They've really, like, ripped up their schedule, done something different. But we've seen with Steph McGovern's lunchtime Channel 4 show, for example, launched from her home during lockdown. You know, we're 1 month into that, and she's basically said, look, enough of this already. I want my house back. Let's do this when we can get a studio.
Well, that's what we hear. I also wonder, because the ratings haven't been fantastic for the show, and I think that's a great shame, because I think she's...
They've been terrible. Sorry, just to be clear.
Yeah, so, well, let's clarify. Yeah. So it's 160,000 viewers a day, right? And, of course, people turning to streaming as well, Jake, which is something Kevin Ligo was talking about. As well, wasn't it, in that Edinburgh TV thing? You know, in peak time, more and more people doing video on demand.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to kind of segue from that point we were making around Channel 4, I think Channel 4's short-term strategy was excellent, to have this lockdown academy and being really agile in the kind of programme that it was showing on television. But the long-term strategy is now starting to become clear. Broadcasters need to move away from this reactive content and be giving viewers... things that they're more used to, bigger, more ambitious shows, because ultimately, if they don't, they will lose out to the streamers. And that's what Kevin Ligo was talking about. You know, at a time when broadcasters are going to have to be showing more repeats because they haven't been able to make the shows that they want to make, ambition has to be raised when things start to return to normal. Otherwise, people are going to get out of the habit of watching telly.
I think it's really interesting what Jake's saying about people want big items that they can watch for a long time, massive dramas and things like that. Look at the success, say, of Twin on BBC on a Saturday night. And that was a completely compelling drama, very different from all this, the corona-based stuff. Took you out of yourself. It was an excellent buy, I think, a really good programme. In the news, you're getting all the stuff you want to know about corona. The rest of the time, you want a bit of escapism and you want something big. And I think that's probably where Channel 4, being so corona conscious, has it's not been the right move.
Well, let's talk about some of the content people are choosing to stream now, because it's not just the big Netflix, Amazon Prime style box sets anymore. It's also, Frank, Hollywood's finest, isn't it? It's the huge movies that were going to debut in the cinemas that are now being available to rent. And it was Trolls that really blazed the trail for that.
Yeah, who would have thought that the story that I would have covered the most in 2020 would be Trolls World Tour? But that's where we're at right now. Because the thing is that's really interesting, so to just give some background on that, is that, you know, Universal, which is owned by Comcast, last month said that they're going to put a lot of the movies that were playing in theaters when theaters were still somewhat minimally open, things like Invisible Man, The Hunt, they were going to give it to PVOD, or Premium Video On Demand. And they made news by saying that Trolls World Tour, which was going to open on April 10th in theaters, or at least was supposed to before theaters closed, was going to play day and date, which means in theaters and on digital the same day. Obviously, theaters closed down, so it went directly to digital, but it's been a big success for them. I mean, it was reported earlier this week that they brought in close to $100 million in rental fees, which is very good for that. But let's have some caveats there. People are stuck home. I would watch, you know, Dwayne The Rock Johnson read a phone book at this point. So, like, people are starving for content. But at the same time, what happened was, in that reporting, NBC Universal Jeff Shell went out of his way to say, you know, that he was incredibly proud of how it all kind of went down, and had this very interesting quote in which he said that he was remarks about putting movies once things reopen on both formats. This really angered theater owners like AMC, which is the world's largest theater chain, to the point where AMC said, we are banning Universal's movies even when we reopen. That means everything from Fast and Furious 9 to Jurassic World to Minions. These are billion-dollar blockbuster movies. But it also opened this debate about what does the theatrical experience and theatrical business look like after this? And that's where we're at right now, is trying to figure out, how are movie theaters going to play? How are we going to watch movies? Is there a market for watching premium films that normally would be in theaters at home? And it looks like there is a market, but I wouldn't count out theaters just yet.
And what's the economic model there, Jake? Because if you're making a movie available to rent through streaming-only services, presumably you get to keep more revenue of the total money that comes in, because you're not paying for the overheads of the cinema and the distribution and the publicity and all that stuff. But at the same time, my understanding is you sort of do, you know, Trolls is the exception that proves the rule. You sort of do need your big theatrical box office opening weekend to get your money back on some of these massive $100 million plus budget titles.
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument the exhibitors all make, that it's absolutely essential to a movie's success that you continue to show it in cinemas. I think this is a fascinating spat, which kind of cuts to the heart of the future of cinema. It's very rare that you see huge rifts like this play out in such a public way, and it'll be fascinating to see how it ends up. I think there's probably a bit of brinksmanship going on here. I mean, theoretically, if AMC continues with its stance, it won't be able to carry James Bond here in the UK through its Odeon cinemas. And I just can't conceive of a scenario where Odeon is not showing James Bond when it's released later this year.
The thing that's really interesting is that, you know, digital platforms take about 80%, the theaters take about 50%. So AMC knows it doesn't have a ton of leverage right now, because these studios can't eventually just go, all right, we're just going to put everything onto streaming or digital. But at the same time, the studios can't necessarily do that too, because you're never going to get the type of money that you can get from a global release. You got to remember, the last Fast and Furious movie made $1.2 billion. You're not going to get close to that in digital, at least not right now. It's going to be a while, not to mention the amount of marketing it takes to tell people where this movie is streaming, where you can buy it, how much you can buy it. And it eats into the home video money as well, because if you're renting Trolls World Tour for $20, 20 American dollars, then you're not going to then buy it again. You've already seen it at home. You know, you can make money from the theater, and then if you like the movie enough, you buy it when you're home. That's a double dip for the studio. So it's this kind of stupid game of chicken going on right now, which is easy to do because there's no movies playing and there's no theaters open. It'll be much different, I think, in about 6 months when, you know, or come November when No Time to Die opens around the world. Then we're actually going to see if the rubber meets the road.
Liz, there's also the issue that we've had 100 years of being brainwashed about the cinematic experience, you know, and I sort of feel like, imagine a scenario that Jake says he can't, where James Bond isn't available in my local Odeon, but it is available in, you know, my local Vue cinema, and it is also available to stream at home. I'd go to the cinema to watch it, because it's a massive movie and I've been trained, whatever equipment I've got at home, the best experience is going to be in the cinema with other people, with the sound system and everything else.
There's a lot of things going on here. I mean, I remember when we were told, like in the 60s, the cinema was dead, you know, everybody was watching TV, there'd be no cinemas, and they've come back, and lots of people do go to the cinema. It's really very interesting, I think, because what we're seeing here is similar to what we're seeing in retail, isn't it? Where shops are saying, well, we don't want to have a sort of face-to-face experience shopping, everything's going to be done online. And this is a chance for everybody to revisit delivery systems, and it's happening not just in entertainment but in other things as well. So I think that what could be happening here is a sort of a rehearsing of this debate. I think it's very odd that these big figures are having this spat. I mean, these people are absolutely surrounded by lawyers and PR men and so on. Why, or PR people, I beg your pardon. So why is it that they are behaving in this way so publicly? It's quite entertaining for the rest of us, but why are they doing this? I think it's a sort of rehearsal of what's going to happen in the future, and they're playing it out.
And Frank, do you think that there'll be some cooperation between the major Hollywood studios to coordinate schedules? once cinemas do reopen, because it's going to be, I guess, the government's decision. I know there are state-by-state decisions. Georgia's already opened some of its movie theatres, hasn't it? But I mean, basically, it needs every state in America to say, okay, we're opening again. And then it sort of needs all the studios to get together, doesn't it? And say, yes, we're doing this. We're going to back the idea that people go to the cinema to see our films, because there is a health risk. There's a public health risk to do that.
Yeah, there definitely is. And I think that it can't work with one, can't work without the other. And they both have to figure out the thing that a lot of people aren't talking about right now, which is the psychological scarring of this. Are people going to want to go to a theater and sit potentially next to people in the dark for 2 hours who are coughing or sneezing or anything like that? I think ultimately where we're heading here, and again, this is the best estimation I can make, I think that what we're going to head to is a reopening at limited capacity. You're going to be potentially having to wear a mask. You're going to not be sitting next to someone. It might be six seats between people. And since the movies are rolling out very limitedly, we could get to a point, say in July, when Christopher Nolan's Tenet comes out, where you have a situation where an AMC theater or a Regal theater or a Cineworld theater is playing just Tenet in, say, 10 of their screens while the other 5 screens are being deeply cleaned. That potentially could be where we're headed. Whether that works, whether people return, is a debatable and something that we'll have to see as time goes on. But I don't think that the movie business and the movie theater business can work without the studios and the theaters coming together, which makes this spat even more kind of ridiculous right now. But, you know, I explained the AMC Universal split as a couple who publicly fights and then 3 weeks later they're back together and you're like, didn't you guys break up? So
that's exactly what I think. There's something contrived about the whole thing. But the other interesting thing I think is if people are wearing masks, they won't be able to eat popcorn. So there's always a silver lining.
Well, we could see the return of the drive-in movie theater as well, couldn't it?
We've actually seen a little bit of a boost of drive-in theaters kind of coming back. I'm bullish on the theatrical experience because I think, you know, it might not be as big as it was, say, in, 1995 or something like that. But I think people are still going to want to have a way to go out and experience the movies with people, get out of their house every now and again. In the same way that there's a difference between watching, a game on television and watching a sporting event in person, it's going to be different. It's going to have to be more about the experience, more about customer loyalty. And I think we're going to have to, I think the studios and the theaters are going to have to figure out how to figure out the theatrical window so that we don't have to wait 90 days to see a new movie come out and watch it at home. I think the big blockbusters like James Bond and Fast and Furious and all of these are going to play in theaters first, and then we'll see how long it takes for them to actually go to digital.
Okay, well, you don't have to wait 90 days for part 2 of the Media Podcast. We'll be back with more media news after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Media Podcast. Liz, Frank and Jake are still with me. Let's talk about Times Radio now. They have announced another raft of talent who will be joining the DAB network this summer. Jake, what do you make of the lineup? Asma Mir is going to be co-hosting Breakfast with Stig Abel. John Pienaar's on Drive Time. We knew that already, but Kathy Newman from Channel 4 News is going to be doing Drive on Friday. What do you think?
It's an impressive lineup of presenters. It'll be really interesting to see what happens when it launches later this summer. I mean, there's still a lot of language around it taking on the BBC and being seen as a rival to Radio 4. And I'm with Matt Deegan, the podcast regular, and he says that if beating the BBC is the measure...
Our resident radio bore.
Yeah, if beating BBC is the measure of success, then it's going to fail and singularly fail. But if it's got more modest ambitions to, you know, act as a megaphone for the Times journalism and to increase subscriptions to the Times, then it could serve a really useful purpose for News UK.
Yeah, well, let me give you my own slightly franker quote from Matt Deegan's blog, Liz. He wrote this week that if taking on Radio 4 ends up being the core aim of Times Radio, the strategy is officially batshit mental. Agree? Disagree?
I think that's absolutely right. I think it's really funny and really right. I myself have been involved in launches of two major media platforms, and also joined Sky News very soon after it was launched. And it's very easy to get totally wrapped up in your product and think it's absolutely great and people are going to flock to it and give, you know, false predictions in the, perhaps you haven't done all your market research or you feel very passionate about it, you're sure it's going to work, yada yada. I'm not saying I haven't done all of those things, but I'm not saying I haven't done their market research and so on, but it does strike me as a dangerous step to take. If this is a Barker channel for the Times newspaper, that's something very different from a radio station in its own right. And it would have to complement the paper, and you'd have to have sort of people migrating from the paper in a way that I don't necessarily see it happening. I tend to think of the Times reader as someone who is a Radio 4 person, and I can't see them going to this radio station for its own sake, and I can't see how it enhances the paper. Perhaps I just feel nervy because of personal experience about launches. It's so many fail.
What's the one that it's reminding you of, Liz? Be specific.
Well, I think when we did GMTV, we had very, really over-positive thoughts about who would transfer from TVAM and what new people we would take on and all of the good things that we could do. And then we had a regulatory system that really didn't help because it opened up the market to Channel 4 Breakfast and so on, the Big Breakfast. I mean, things can come at you that you don't expect, and there are costs involved. And also, I think what Matt Deegan said about Virgin Radio with Chris Evans, which did very well, was done very well, relatively speaking, but it's a little fraction of the Radio 4 audience. It's a dangerous move, I think. And I don't want to sound so negative about it, because it's great to think of people starting up radio, but there's something about this that I think is a little confused. Is it the Barker channel, or is it in its own right?
Well, I suppose the confusing element there, Jake, is that none of these presenters that they've announced actually have columns in the Times. I mean, maybe they will in due course. But there were people that they could have put right front and centre of their schedule. Actually, I corrected myself. Matt Chorley does have a column.
I was going to say Matt Chorley. He's doing Big Mornings. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
All right. But still, they could have had David Aronovich. They could have had Giles Corran. They could have had Caitlin Moran. They haven't gone with those names. They've gone with more experienced radio names.
Yeah, but there's no reason why those more established columnists won't be contributing on a regular basis.
I mean, Frank, from your position in the US, does it seem kind of amusing that we're being a bit churlish about the idea of anyone taking on the BBC? I mean, over there in the US, you know, the idea of a newspaper, if the New York Times wanted to launch its own radio station, it would seem like an obvious and straightforward thing to do to drive subscribers. And you wouldn't be thinking, well, can they beat the biggest? It would be like, can they create a new entrant?
Yeah, I mean, I would look at it from my point of view as being like, that's a way for them to grab more readers, grab more viewers, grab more listeners. I mean, that doesn't sound very outrageous to me, but that's just me being on the other side of the pond.
But also the interesting thing is it's the Times itself that's been framing it in this way. You know, there was a write-up in the Times about these new presenters, and it used language like taking on the BBC and seen as a direct rival to the to Radio 4. You know, if it's doing that itself, then it's obvious that other people are going to make similar comparisons.
Yeah, and then what they haven't announced yet, Liz, but it seems to me are an obvious part of the puzzle as they actually launched the station in the summer are Radio 4 type commissions, you know, sort of half hour programs, returning series, broadening in that. I mean, at the moment, this just seems like kind of upmarket talk radio, but it's obviously not going to be just that. And then they obviously are going for a Radio 4 audience.
Well, that's a big expense. And I don't really get the business model for this. If it is, as I keep saying, a pocket channel for the Times, that's a very different thing from a radio station in its own right. And, you know, as again, Matt Deegan says, there are so many people that try these radio stations and fail. I don't know. I don't want to sound too negative, and I'm not a radio expert, but it does make me feel a bit uncomfortable. I don't quite see how it's going to make it.
Okay, let's stick with radio just for a moment, because the BBC are now offering their news bulletins to commercial rivals who might be struggling with production during the pandemic. Jake, do you imagine many commercial stations are going to be queuing up to take BBC bulletins?
I don't know the question to that, the answer to that question, honestly. I mean, I think it's a... For the BBC to have made this offer, again, I think it suggests that there may be the appetite for this. I mean, the BBC itself has warned that some of its local services could be at risk during coronavirus. That hasn't transpired, and it clearly has confidence in the work that it's producing to make this offer to radio stations. I think it's part of the sort of good feeling around the BBC at the moment that it's providing these public services. It's plugging gaps where commercial operators might be struggling, and is, you know, providing a proper service to local audiences.
I guess the question, Liz, is whether this relationship would then continue once we're out of the quarantine times. I mean, at the moment, particularly for community radio stations that either are run by volunteers or have furloughed everybody, it makes sense to take a BBC News bulletin. But then at what point do you say, right, we need to start producing our own again and we need to put our own expense into that? Is it something that the publicly funded broadcasters should be propping up? Is it good PR for the BBC? Where does it end?
Well, you're talking about a relationship between commercial radio stations and the BBC, and we don't really know that there is a relationship. I mean, Ken Macquarie, the director of BBC Nations and Regions, said, we have been approached by a number of stations, but we have no idea which stations they are, and we don't know if there is genuinely a demand for this, or if this is the BBC making an offer which makes the BBC look good. So I don't know, and I can't imagine, unless they're absolutely desperate, a commercial radio station taking this on. Wouldn't it be more likely that they would do one composite bulletin for a whole lot of stations, and they've gone down to some extent anyway? I think this is a little bit odd, and the idea of this going on in the future, I mean, there is, of course, local TV, which has got to deal with the BBC, but that actually bizarrely is the other way around. Local television is supposed to provide material to the BBC, which doesn't really happen. To have the BBC providing bulletins for commercial local radio stations doesn't seem to me to be something that the commercial local radio stations would want. From the point of view of the BBC, they are something that's funded by the licence fee. It's funded nationally. It doesn't have any commercial funding. And the radio stations are going to be far more vulnerable at this time. So given that it's paid for by the taxpayer, as it were, the licence fee payer, perhaps the BBC should offer to support these commercial organisations. But I think a commercial organisation that accepts that would put themselves in a very difficult position.
Another thing the BBC is doing is supporting the nation's children as they're locked down and away from school by announcing some big celebrity names fronting educational content on the bite-sized portion of their website. So these are big names over here in the UK, Frank, like Sir David Attenborough and Professor Brian Cox. We've got Ed Balls, former Labour Chancellor, doing maths lessons. Do you think this is sort of celebrities doing their bit, or do you think there will be a backlash in the sense of talent, and this is the same in Hollywood as it is over here in the UK, sort of just constantly filming themselves at home, looking a little bit needy? I mean, there comes a point where, as a viewer, you're sort of like, put it away, like, you just retreat for a while.
Yeah, it's been really, really interesting to see how celebrities have kind of had to adjust to this new world and how that's kind of worked out. I mean, because when we think of celebrities, it's very prim, very polished. Like, you know, you don't get to really see behind the veil. Like, you just basically see what they want you to see. But now, you know, I've been telling people one of the most fun games I've been doing lately is looking in celebrities' homes and seeing, like, what is behind them and what kind of books are they reading on those bookshelves. models and things of that nature. So I think there, you know, initially, I think a lot of celebrities had some backlash because they were trying to react in a way that they thought would be normal. But then as soon as this kind of became more and more a new kind of way of life, you've seen celebrities, and I'll use an example of like the late night shows in America. You know, people like Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel, they've all had to do their shows from home. And initially that was kind of a rough and tumble type of situation. But as it's gone on, it's really gotten smoothed out and it's really worked. The same thing even for something like Saturday Night Live in America. It originally had a remote show, and then eventually last week they had their second remote show, and it was one of the best shows they've had all season. So I think celebrities are trying to figure it out. And I think that what you were saying about the educational portions of this is actually really heartening. I think it's really something that could actually be, you know, beneficial to celebrities and to how they're perceived in public going forward as this kind of drags out.
I think the perception issue is part of the cynicism around it, though, isn't it, Jake? I mean, to an 8-year-old, it doesn't matter whether it's a really good maths teacher teaching you maths or Ed Balls. It only matters to the media that are reporting on the fact that people are doing it to drive people to go to the website to check it out. Do you think they should be using their big names in that way?
Are you saying you wouldn't want to get science lessons from Brian Cox?
I mean, I'm saying an 8-year-old might not.
Yeah,
might not care particularly.
You might want to learn Spanish from Sergio Aguero if you're an 8-year-old and you're a mad football fan. I think, I mean, it's partly aimed at the children. I think it's probably more aimed at the parents and a tool to get the parents to get the parents watching, who are then turn and get then in turn engage their children with what's going on in the bite-sized videos. So I think it's quite smart in a way. Like Frank was saying, it's, you know, it's a real public service. It's the BBC doing what it does best, and you know, it should be providing these educational tools for children when schools are closed.
Liz, do you think the right decision, though, to kind of silo it off on the website, you know, here's the educational stuff, and basically keep CBBS and CBBC dedicated to entertainment? I mean, obviously there's educational values through all of those shows, but it's not a pure lesson.
No, I think that's very wise to put it on the website and to separate it off from the entertainment side of the children's provision. What I would like to say is that I think that this is great, and why not? But it's really a drop in the ocean. I'm the chair of a school governors board, and actually getting material to children in packs that they can utilize, and recognizing that so many of your children don't necessarily have access to first-class Wi-Fi, or, you know, they don't have enough devices in the home and so on. There are so many other problems to deal with that this is nice, but it's in no way fundamental.
Okay, just briefly, finally, on the BBC, can we talk about their 50-50 gender parity project? Liz, has this come out of some of the work that you've been doing? It is about female contributors on news programmes, isn't it?
No, it's not about news programmes. It's about all factual programmes, as I understand it. And it's much more recent that we've been doing the Expert Women project since 2012, and in fact a little bit before that, though not so formally. And this is a very different venture. What 50-50 does is ask for 50-50 gender representation on factual programmes. But
it's not very different in terms of methodology, though, is it? They are literally counting women on screen just as you've been.
They're counting women in a different way. So we are counting women who are experts or authority figures, and they're just counting women. And they're also not including what they might call players, people that that the editors of news programmes say that they have to put on.
Yeah, like the Prime Minister, for example.
The Prime Minister or the Prime Minister, whatever, whereas we count everybody. So it's very different. What I always say is that 50-50 is great, but if you have a 50-50 system, then the magician and his glamorous assistant are 50-50. But in fact, the magician and his glamorous assistant are very different in the significance on the programme and the significance socially. So we count expert women and authority figures, and the sort of things that we are coming up with are rather different from 50-50. It's good if you look at the two together. It's very good to look and say, oh, yes, we've got, you know, 50% of the guests on this programme are women. That is obviously a good thing. But you also need to look at what those guests are representing. If it's just men and their wives, then it's not really doing gender equality any favours.
OK, let's tackle the tabloids next, because the Duke and Duchess of Sussex handed four British titles their own version of a Dear John letter last week. Jake, this was The Sun, The Daily Mail, The Mirror and The Express. And pretty unprecedented, isn't it, in the UK for members of the royal family to take such affirmative action against the tabloids?
Yes. I mean, look, first of all, I fully respect their desire for privacy, particularly given that they're now, you know, independent of the public purse. But there was something a little bit chilling about this letter. And I think the bottom line is, I don't think it will make the blindest bit of difference either. Journalists will keep calling them and keep asking them about stories. And the question I would ask is it the best attitude to so-called fake news? They're calling it fake news, to ignore fake news or allegations that are being put to you, and then not, you know, taking up your right of reply. I don't think that's the best way of handling fake news. I think the
best
way
they've said they'll have a policy of zero engagement from their people, which means that they can't deny things that they might want on the record are untrue.
Yes. That, exactly. But like I say, I think journalists will keep calling. And I mean, they're saying that they'll deal with journalists through their lawyers. Well, the journalists will just phone their lawyers for comment. They won't phone their spokespeople. And the other thing about this, they keep saying that it's a deluge of fake news. But The Sun has been on the money with some of the big stories about their personal affairs in the last few months.
Like the fact they were going to leave the royal family.
Exactly. And, they've got it right. So I'm sure there is a lot of nastiness and ill-informed, inaccurate reporting about Harry and Meghan. Absolutely, I'm sure that's the case. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't engage when there are legitimate stories about their future.
Frank, can you shine any light for us on Sunshine Saks, which is the PR outfit that they've employed in the States to represent their affairs now that they're no longer represented by the palace?
It's a very notable PR company here, and it's very interesting they would do it, because when you think of Sunshine Saks, you think of celebrities, and it just kind of shows that transformation, I guess you could call it, from being royal celebrities to being celebrities is kind of underway, at least on the stateside.
What do you make of Harry following Meghan into TV? He's going to be introducing an episode of Thomas the Tank Engine shortly.
I think it's really interesting. And I think that, you know, it's kind of obvious to say there's always been a lot of attention around the royal family. That has always been the case. But in the States, I would argue that there hasn't been this much attention around a couple like this since the days of Princess Diana. I would make that argument that, you know, with Harry and Meghan kind of moving into a more kind of less royal, more celebrity type of profession, I think that you see more of an attention going forward. I mean, there was that video that was shown, I think it was late last year, where Harry was talking to Disney CEO Bob Iger about Meghan does voice work. And then, then we see that Meghan's doing voice work on an elephants documentary on Disney+. It's really quite interesting. And I think that it just kind of, it brings them more forth in the American culture, because now it's less, you know, focused on that is, this is a couple from a royal family from a different country. They've become almost a little bit more Americanized through their celebrity, which is quite interesting.
Liz, do you think that their behavior recently is going to piss off the palace more or piss off Fleet Street more? Because Fleet Street are going to continue to report on them, whether with their cooperation or not. It's the Queen's people, I imagine, that have spent, you know, the last 30 years creating a very delicate relationship where the tabloids can report in a certain way about Harry and Wills and their schooling and his time in the army and all this stuff. And they've just turned around and said, everything he wrote about us was a lie.
Yeah, I mean, the ecology of this particular relationship has been deeply upset by the way Harry and Meghan have behaved. On the other hand, I can really appreciate, I think a lot of us who've had bad experiences of the tabloid press. I mean, I had a bad experience with the tabloid press, but it was a long time ago. But it does injure you, and you do feel that you are just completely victimized by these people. And I can quite understand why they've behaved like they have. There's a certain sort of hoity-toityness about it. It probably would have been better just not to have engaged with them and not sent a letter. I mean, that's like drawing attention to the feud and probably not terribly wise, but it's sort of understandable. And in the end, the difficulty for them is if they want to be celebrities, then they're going to have to engage with the tabloids in some way, because that's what celebrities are all about. websites, the tabloids, that, you know, it's the attention that they're going to need. They're going to need the oxygen of attention, and they may well lose everything by trying to have it both ways.
And Liz, just finally before the media quiz, give us some good news regarding the Jewish Chronicle, which faced closure a few weeks ago. They've now found a buyer.
Yeah, it's really good, and it's been quite messy, but they've been bailed out, and they aren't going to have to combine with the Jewish News, which is the other great Jewish press organ, if you like, in this country. And the Chronicle is something that's iconic, really, and it's the oldest Jewish newspaper that we've had in the UK. Also, Stephen Pollard, I have to say, years ago, Stephen Pollard wrote something really nasty and unkind about me. But I'm going to reply by saying he's a very good journalist and I like what he writes, largely when it's not about me. And I think
he's keeping his job as editor.
Yeah, I think that's great. So it is good news. And it's so good to see a newspaper title being retained.
There is just time. You'll be pleased to know, all of you, to play our legendary media quiz. Today, we play HBO or No. Ahead of the launch of yet another premium subscription streaming service, HBO Max, coming to American screens on May the 27th, we've been given a tease of what new programming we might expect to be available on Sky here in the UK. So, I'm going to give you the title and premise of an original programming premiering on HBO Max in May. You just have to tell me if it's genuine or if we made it up. Okay, is the following HBO or No? A kids' craft competition called Craftopia, hosted by YouTuber Law DIY.
Liz, that's genuine.
It is. It is HBO. Host Lauren challenges a series of crafty children to make amazing creations for the chance to win $5,000. Here is programme number two. HBO or No? A scripted comedy called Happy Wife, Happy Life, starring Anna Faris and Terry Crews.
Liz, Jake? No.
Liz pipped you there, Jake. And Liz, you are correct. That is No. That was made up, and it was inspired by the new Anna Kendrick vehicle, Love Life. Programme number three, HBO or No? An underground ballroom dance competition series called Legendary.
Jake. HBO.
Correct. This series sparked controversy over the role presenter and actor Jameela Jamil would play, but the trailer promises big production values and the shiniest floor ever. And finally, the unscripted reunion of the cast of Friends, HBO or No?
Frank. That's real.
It is HBO. And due to arrive later in the year, once cast and crew are allowed to be in the same room together again. Now, I know, Frank, that CNN is part of the same conglomerate, but do you think it's going to be as big a program as they reckon it's going to be? Like, Friends, if they started making Friends again, obviously huge. But a reunion where they sit around and say, wasn't it great? I don't know if I need to see that.
I'm saying this, and I'm not just saying this because I work at the same company that is making HBO Max. I 100% think that's going to be a hit because Friends is just the thing on streaming. People love Friends. Just to see those actors together, I think will actually be a quite boon for HBO Max. I think it's going to be a big hit for them.
And good news for Sky subscribers, Jake, that actually, I guess a lot of this, thanks to the deal they have with Sky, is going to be coming to people that have got Sky Q for free or not for more on top of their current subscription. They won't have to get another one.
Yeah, I mean, it's great news, obviously, that we're going to see some of this. And, you know, that deal with HBO has been in place for a long time and it's served Sky really well. I think the Friends reunion not happening because of coronavirus is a real blow, actually, to HBO Max because it would have acted as a big hook on launch for people to come and check out the service. And obviously it's not going to have that now.
But, I mean, Liz, you can't really get a better time of the world, really, to launch a streaming service than when everyone's locked down in their house. I mean, they are giving themselves the best possible opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Look what happened to Disney. You know, they're taking off, as we talked right at the start of the podcast. So it is a good time. I really am amused, by the way, by, I think it's on ITV, they're going to rerun some ancient old football tournament. And the ad for it, the promo, is really funny because it says, we're going to do this. Why are we doing this? And this voice says, because we're all stuck at home. I would watch the Friends reunion.
Well, you can go off and watch a streaming service right now, Liz, but of course not the Friends reunion because it doesn't exist yet. And congratulations on winning the quiz.
I won!
Yep. Thanks to Frank Pallotta, Jake Cantor and Liz Howell. And thank you to you. You can catch up with previous episodes and get new ones as soon as they're released by subscribing for free on our website, themediapodcast.com. Whilst you're there, you might fancy taking out a voluntary subscription to help keep us going all year round. Head to themediapodcast.com/donate and choose a voluntary donation that suits you. We'd be ever so grateful, Gov. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Rebecca Grisdale-Sherry. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. And until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.